Not if you put on your 3D glasses, honey. I don't know. This because your husband, or whatever he is, doesn't want you to take the job?
Bob Harris was studying her face. He was the kind of man who took a lot of pride in being able to read people, and it seemed he read her correctly.
Huh. If I were married to a woman like you, I wouldn't sell her short.
Yeah, you all think that. You all think you'll like it, but when it happens, you don't like it at all.
I didn't say I'd like it, but I'd like to think I'd take advantage of the opportunity.
At that moment, it was clear to Nora that Bob Harris was thinking of making a play for her, and that Nora was thinking of finally giving in. But an expert on body language, like the ones who were always popping up on TV analyzing the president, could have told you by the rise and then the fall of their clavicles that almost simultaneously, both of them thought, nah. It was the beginning of what would be a wonderful professional relationship. In the years to come, they would feel that they might be the only man and woman in New York who had honest conversations.
You should be with that guy, Jenny said, when Nora described one of their interactions.
Why ruin a good thing? Nora had replied.
The city has informed residents that they will discontinue weekly baiting for rodent traps and will move to a monthly schedule. A firm has been retained to check traps and rebait when necessary to supplement the city plan. The cost will be divided among owners who agree to participate. No traps will be checked or rebaited in the area of homes not participating. George.
Broom clean, it said in the contract. The house was to be delivered, broom clean. Nora had smiled when she saw the words. Obviously, the buyer's attorney was unfamiliar with the body of work of Charity Barrett, who had snaked a vacuum hose into the heating and dryer vents, who had actually scrubbed the grout in Ollie's bathroom with something just a bit bigger than a toothbrush, who had waxed the parquet so thoroughly that Nora was concerned the new owners would go flying if they walked quickly across the living room. In this operating theater atmosphere, redolent of lemon, Lysol, and bleach, it was jarring to see a sheet of paper on the foyer floor. Her last Georgiogram. Nora thought perhaps she should keep it as a memento, show it to the twins. Then she threw it in the last bag of trash waiting to go downstairs. She was surprised that she was still on George's list. Perhaps he thought the newcomers were already in residence. The week before, Nora had solved the greatest problem she thought she was leaving the buyers of her house. She'd walked from her new apartment to the block just after dawn. She wasn't sleeping well, but it would take more than insomnia to make her hit the sidewalk before first light, when rats might still be foraging, and seen a woman putting a plastic bag on her front stoop.
"Wait just a minute!"
Nora shouted. The woman froze for a moment, then pivoted with her hands on her hips. Nora couldn't help but notice that she was wearing a pair of small Sayings workout pants, the Thoreau capri, with "I stand in awe of my body" inside the waistband. It was a sentence that smacked so flagrantly of yoga studio and empowerment jargon that Nora had insisted Christine double-check that Thoreau had actually said it.
"No, you wait just a minute. I'm going to keep doing this until you stop letting your nasty little dogs go on the sidewalk in front of our building. I've stepped in it too many times to count, and I'm sick of it. So I'm picking it up and putting it where it belongs, at your front door."
"My dog's dead," Nora said. And to her surprise, she found herself in tears, as though saying it aloud had made it suddenly true.
"What?"
"My dog died 6 months ago."
"All of them?"
"I only had one."
"Oh, come on. The doorman next door to my building said there were at least two, sometimes three. He said the man who lived in this house walked them in front of our building and never picked up after them."
"What kind of dogs?"
"Some little dogs with bug eyes. I always forget the name. The ones who look like some kind of space alien."
She raised her hands in the air.
"I'm a cat person," she said.
Nora bent and gingerly picked up the bag. "You've been leaving these at the wrong house," she said. "The person you want lives right across the street. The doorman gave you the wrong address."
"Are you sure?"
the woman said. And as though conjured by a magic trick, at that moment George came down the ramshackle steps of his house with three of his rescue pugs pulling on their leashes in front of him. The woman stared, then snatched the bag from Nora's hand.
"Sorry," she cried,
as she sprinted across the street. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Nora stepped inside and thought that George might never speak to her again, and hoped against hope that that would be the case, and then realized that it didn't matter, that she was unlikely to run into George for the rest of both their lives. In that way that things sometimes happen, Nora was doing the last walkthrough before the afternoon closing when she heard the doorbell ring. The house was completely empty. When she sneezed, it echoed. She had closed the door of Rachel's closet, which still had middle school graffiti, RN and AB. Which boy was that? I hate you, probably a message for her mother. Various hearts and stars. She had refused to let Charity scrub it off. She'd also decided to let the area behind the kitchen door stand, the one in which they had measured the twins every year on their birthday. Pencil marks on paint. Oliver and Rachel, 12, she taller by several inches. Rachel and Oliver, 14, after a growth spurt that had pushed his height up an inch and his voice down an octave. In college, Rachel had insisted she was still growing when Ollie topped out at 6 feet and Rachel was 4 inches shorter. Dream on, her brother had said, patting her on the head. Nora had taken a picture of the wall. Some day she would send it to her children, but not yet. The bell rang again. A man with black hair, brown skin, and khaki clothes stood at the door. Two other men, similar enough that no one on the block would ever be able to tell them all apart, stood behind him. All three were wearing backpacks.
Hello, missus,
the man who was obviously in charge said, up talking like a private school girl in 8th grade.
My name is Joe. I do home repairs. My men will clean the sidewalks and shovel snow. Good prices for you.
What's your real name, Joe?
Joe.
He smiled and nodded. Nora noticed that he had no index finger on one hand, and as he saw her noticing, he curled his fingers into fists.
I work for Mr. George across the street, also Mrs. Wooden.
Nora hadn't met the Woodens yet, and supposed now she never would. They had just acquired a house near the corner. As far as Nora could tell, they had no dogs. Do you have a card, Joe? Nora said. This isn't really my house, but I'll pass it along. That afternoon, she had given the card to the couple at the closing. They'd paid 5 times what she and Charlie had. You'll need a handyman, Nora said, as she signed paper after paper, first with her own name, then with Charlie's, because he had not wanted to be there and had given her power of attorney. Nora didn't need a handyman, not anymore. She had a super instead. She lived now on the 15th floor of a new building, a white box with partial views of the river, along with an endless vista of wooden water towers and tarred roofs, that all-you-can-eat buffet of Manhattan aloft. Nora loved the light and the air. She loved not being known. She loved that there was no wainscoting, no molding, no charm, no history. She liked the nothingness of it, the blank slate. Wasn't this what living in New York was supposed to be like? The skyline, the anonymity, coexistence without intimacy? How did you sleep? Nora asked when Rachel came to town and stayed in the guest room. Good, her daughter said. It's like staying in a really nice hotel. Ouch, Nora said, making coffee in the tiny kitchen, which was just the right size for what she needed in a kitchen for now. Rachel stood next to her, hip to hip. The night before, they had watched trash TV with their legs entwined on the couch. Now Nora leaned into her daughter, feeling small and sad. I like nice hotels, Rachel said. She opened the refrigerator. No plain yogurt? She said as she took a banana from the bowl. First world problem, Nora said. Mommy, I love you, but no one says that anymore, Rachel said. She hoisted herself until she was sitting on the counter, her legs dangling, the way she'd like to do when she was in middle school. So, how are you, really? Rachel said. And that's not a rhetorical question. I take a lot of pleasure in having children who know what a rhetorical question is, Nora said, carrying coffee mugs to the dining table as her daughter followed. The table was new. The cups had been around for a long time. Charlie hadn't wanted much of the kitchen stuff. He actually hadn't wanted much at all. She sat down and looked at Rachel and worked to keep her voice flat. It depends on the day, Nora said. Sometimes I'm sad, and sometimes I'm okay, and sometimes I'm
even a little happy. And sometimes I think we made the wrong decision. But mostly I think we made the right one. I spend a lot of time worrying about you and your brother. And we both spend a lot of time worrying about you. And how are you? Also, not a rhetorical question. Nice deflection, though, Rachel said, hugging her mug, biting her lower lip, shifting in her chair the way she did, all those little mannerisms that Nora knew so well. I'm all right, in spite of everything. A year ago, not so much. I started feeling as though in my whole life I'd never really made a decision. Everything in my life just sort of happened. The guys I wound up with, my friends, they were just there. Like, even college, it was sort of, okay, I've been here for reunions, it's beautiful, it's a great school, that's fine, but making the decision to leave New York to do something so different from what anyone else I knew was doing, it just felt so good to decide something all by myself. I know you think what I do is kind of lame and random. I do not. But I made a big decision, and now I make small decisions every single day, and they may only be decisions about whether a onesie should have snaps or a zipper, but I'm the one making them. I can say from experience that whether a onesie has snaps or a zipper is an important decision. I vote zipper, babe. So did I, Rachel said, and looked at her watch. Oh, no, I'm going to be late for the Cotton Council meeting. And no judgment, please. You're talking to a woman who once sucked up to the Gemological Institute of America. No judgment. At the door, as she was leaving in her grown-up suit, Rachel hugged her hard and said, I'm glad you're here. It might be even harder if you were at the house without Daddy, or he was there without you. This is nice. It's a nice place. It's a nice place, Jenny had said too, following the long hallway to the bedrooms, opening the glass-fronted kitchen cabinets, looking down on the buildings below. Did Rachel approve? She pretended to. There was a lot of pretending. I don't know what was worse, the pain last year or the pretending now. It's a dialectic. Wait for the synthesis. Thank you, Professor. Really, I like this place. It's a new you. Is it? Or is it the old me with new furniture? I like the new furniture. The white couch is great. Jenny leaned in toward the view until her forehead touched the window glass. That roof garden must have cost a fortune, she said, looking down at the top of the brick building across the street. I've literally never seen anyone using it, Nora said, standing next to her. Jenny put her arm around Nora's waist and squeezed. Should I get a dog? Nora said. It depends, Jenny said. Do you really want a dog, or do you think you should get a dog because it will make you seem like nothing has changed? Nora sighed. I've always wanted a white couch, she said. If you get a dog, get one who won't jump on the furniture, Jenny said. It was funny, Nora sometimes thought, how after the shock of becoming a separated person, of losing not only her home but her entire way of thinking about herself and her life, she had woken up one morning and realized that she would survive, that her former life was like a dress she had loved, but that no tailor could take in after all the weight she'd lost. She wasn't stupid. She was working long hours at her new job, hiring staff, setting up systems, visiting schools, and instead of weekends only, she was running every morning through the park in the half-light. Keeping busy, that's what they called it. She knew there was a chance that someday she would sit down at the table at which she ate breakfast and feel loneliness like a flu, hot and achy and terrible everywhere. The kind of feeling that made you want to stay in bed. Didn't that happen sometimes, even when you were still married? Jenny had asked. Somehow, she and Charlie had both wound up with what they hadn't known they'd always wanted. One evening they had gone to dinner with Lizzie's parents, along with Oliver and Lizzie, and it had been as though they were still together in some strange way, but better. Nothing had happened in the last day or the last week to make anyone annoyed with the other. There was no irritating subtext as they sat around the table, Nora talking about the foundation to Lizzie's mother, who headed a small private school, Charlie talking about the market to Lizzie's father, who was a hospital administrator. The only thing that made it odd was the end of the evening, standing on the pavement, executing that dance of moving from saying goodnight to actually leaving.
That was a nice evening, Charlie had said.
Really nice, Nora said. And then it was cheek kiss, and turn away in opposite directions. Charlie had headed east, while Nora went north. Nora had glimpsed something, just for a moment, on her son's face. And next morning, when the two of them had breakfast, she said, "Don't let what happened make you relationship shy." Oliver smiled a little sadly.
"Mom, I draw conclusions based on all available data."
"And if the data is contradictory?" she said, thinking of Lizzie's parents, her mother's arm looped through her father's, reflexively, as they walked from the restaurant to the corner for a cab. Although, who knew what that really meant? Charlie and Nora had looked like that to outsiders, so that when Nora had told her father they were separated, he had said, "You're kidding."
"If the data is contradictory, I continue to study the subject," Oliver said.
That first Thanksgiving, Nora and Charlie had gone together, as usual, to her father and Carol in Connecticut.
"Always welcome, always welcome," her father had said as he pumped Charlie's hand.
The food had been the same, and the conversation too, although Oliver had gone to Lizzie's and Rachel stayed in Seattle and had dinner with Christine. Nora assumed that next year Charlie would have Thanksgiving dinner with his woman friend, and the following year she might be his second wife, and so on and so forth. It was funny how easy it was to predict the fine points of the future, and how the big things were incomprehensible until they were right there on paper. Certificate of dissolution of marriage. Sometimes she thought about the block and wondered whether she'd wanted it because she knew it was what was wanted. Whether life, at least in New York City, was an inchoate search for authenticity when imitation was always dangled before you like a great prize.
"Your new job sounds amazing," Suzanne said wistfully when their women's group met for lunch. "There are only so many swatches you can look at before you feel as though you're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Thank God I'm done with that house downtown, although I do miss seeing James. That man is to die for."
"Have people finally stopped with the leopard carpeting?" said Jenny, giving Nora a look across the table. Suzanne shook her head. 10 years from now, I will watch while every client decides to pull it out, if I'm even doing this 10 years from now."
"One mistake I never made," said Jenny, leaning over her bowl of soup.
"You used to say that about marriage," Elena said, and Nora felt a movement under the table and realized that one of the other women had kicked Elena. "I mean that Jenny used to talk about how terrible marriage was, and now she's married." Kick, kick. "What?" yelled Elena, and Nora started to laugh. "First of all, Jenny wasn't the one who used to talk about how terrible marriage was," Nora said, looking around the table. "And second of all, I promise everyone I will not fall apart if you mention marriage, weddings, husbands, or even boyfriends."
"Is there a boyfriend?" Kathleen said, her eyes enormous, and someone kicked her, too.
"She bought a white couch," Jenny said.
"You bought a new couch and didn't ask to use my designer discount?" Suzanne said. "I'm hurt."
"You're busy. I saw it in a showroom window and bought it on impulse. I'd forgotten how much I wanted one."
"It's every mother's fantasy piece of furniture," Suzanne said. "You can tell who won't let her kids in the living room by whether they order one. Some of them might as well have a velvet rope at the living room entrance."
"My kids are too old for jelly hands," Nora said. "Have you lost weight?" Elena said. Kick.
"What's wrong with asking if she lost weight?" Kick. "I'm going to be black and blue by the time this lunch is over."
A block away from Nora's new apartment was a nice restaurant where she sometimes had business breakfasts before she headed uptown to her new office, a restaurant where they now smiled and led her always to the same table in the corner. It was there one morning that she saw Alma Fenstermacher across the room, reading a thriller and eating an omelet with quiet concentration. The seat across from Alma was empty, and Nora threaded her way between the tables to stand behind it. Alma looked up, and the delight in her eyes was immediate and unfeigned. She took a ballet class 2 mornings a week, of course she did, Nora thought, and the studio was nearby. Joe worked for the families on the block now, and Alma said she had heard he was good, although perhaps not quite as good as Ricky had been. The people who'd bought the Nolan house were lovely, although the younger boy was said to be a bit of a handful. The couple who had bought the Fisk house were doing a renovation and hadn't moved in yet. Nora told her that Oliver was preparing to apply to graduate school, and that Rachel had gotten a promotion and was helping to oversee Christine's new line of clothing. "It's called Smaller Sayings," Nora said. "It's the same thing she did with workout clothes, but for children."
"The future is now," said Alma.
"Oh my goodness," Nora said. "That's their biggest seller. Apparently they can't keep up with the demand. That and Sleep Tight. Both of those are Rachel's."
"I bought them both for a baby shower last month," Alma said.
"Does Rachel like living there?"
"I think she's just happy to be away at the moment. If she says one more time that people are so real there, I'm going to scream."
"Ah, yes," said Alma Fenstermacher, who had children in St. Louis and Chicago.
"The much-vaunted Western authenticity."
"Not like New York."
"Not a bit," Alma said, buttering her toast.
"Perhaps they're right about that. I knew a woman here who talked ceaselessly about her years at Wellesley, how happy she'd been there, what a wonderful classical education she'd received, how beautiful the campus was. I was actually with her at a tea when she ran into two women from the same class at Wellesley. They both said they remembered her. One even said they'd been in a seminar on the Lake Poets together. I won't go into chapter and verse about how I came to know this, but the closest she'd ever been to Wellesley was a secretarial school on 23rd Street."
"Oh, that's so sad." Alma smiled slightly. "I admired her when I found out. What a production. To create a life from whole cloth. Although maybe that's what we all do. Tell me about your work. From what I can gather, that horrid woman never deserved you."
"The school she visited, the projects she was thinking of funding, the kids who had so little and needed so much. Nora wouldn't have gone on so long if Alma hadn't seemed so interested and even ordered another cup of coffee. She told her about the first grant she'd made, creating a computer lab at a school that had been relying solely on a pair of aged desktops, and how the principal had started to cry when she'd seen the room finished, the students sitting at the new computers. Nora had started to cry, too, because after all those years of asking rich people for money, she realized how much more pleasurable it was to give it away where it was really, truly needed. The thing was, Bob Harris had come with her for this inaugural gift, and he'd wept, too. "Thank you," Nora had said to him when they came out of the school building onto a littered street with a cracked blacktop basketball court.
"Let's get these people some decent playground equipment," Bob had said.
She didn't mention to Alma the day that she had realized she was in the neighborhood and had steeled herself to stop by Ricky's apartment. When she knocked at the door, a tiny girl in denim cutoffs with an infant on her shoulder and a toddler wrapped around her shin answered.
"Oh, they're gone," she said.
A young guy buying lunch in the corner bodega said,
"Ricky, he won the lottery, man. He got so much money now he can't spend it. He's got millions."
The old man outside by the hydrant in the folding chair said,
"That fool inside don't know what he's talking about. Millions, millions. Anytime anybody gets some money around here, they say it's millions. Ricky didn't win the lottery. He got money for some big lawsuit. A lot of money, but not millions. Maybe 400,000 or 500,000. It's a nice piece of change, I will say that. The man limps, but come on. I'd limp for a couple $100,000 in a nice house. You want a Dr. Pepper, miss? I got a whole cooler of them here."
"Where's the house?"
"The DR, the Dominican Republic. That's where Nita's mom lives. Her sisters, a couple of cousins, they open a restaurant."
"That's a good way to lose a lot of money."
"That's okay. He's got a lot of money now. Not millions, though."
"I heard it was a million," said the young guy,
coming outside with his sandwich and a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
"He should have gotten that guy to hit him. He should have made him pay instead of letting him off." "He made him pay, fool," said the older man, cracking a Dr. Pepper with a hiss. "He made him pay with cash money. You got a choice between putting a guy away and taking his money. I take the money every time."
"Both,"
the younger man said.
"You're dreaming," said the other.
Alma Fenstermacher finally asked for the check.
"I wish I could stay all day," she said, as though she meant it. "I miss you. I miss Sherry. You should visit."
She saw the look on Nora's face and said,
"No, I suppose not. That was unthinking."
Has anyone told you that the lot is gone? It's gone? It's sold? Someone finally made an offer that was simply too large to turn aside. So Mr. Stoller agreed to sell. Alma leaned in and smiled kindly at Nora, the way someone smiles at a child who has been good about putting her napkin on her lap and using her fork.
I will tell you a secret, she said. Sidney Stoller has been dead for years.
Are you certain? Alma sat back.
Absolutely certain. I'm his daughter.
Then she laughed, a throaty laugh.
Oh, Nora, the look on your face.
Nora's mind was clicking like a Geiger counter, going over all the assumptions they'd made on the block. Greenwich, finishing school, one of the Seven Sisters colleges, even a debutante ball, or at least a big society wedding. And she realized that unlike the Wellesley woman, whose story had obviously been proffered publicly for her own reasons, Alma had never provided any of it. The decor of her home, the timbre of her voice, the cut of her clothes, all of them had assembled her biography from the way she was in the world.
Someone is building a home there, Alma continued. The Landmarks Commission has led them a pretty dance with their plans, and the end result is that they're obliged to build a kind of ersatz Victorian townhouse. I feel a bit sorry for them, actually.
And what about the people who parked in the lot?
Oh, goodness. They'll find someplace else. I have to say, the greatest pleasure of the entire transaction, other than the size of the check involved, was listening to George complain. Although, of course, I didn't tell him that we were the ones who were selling. The bank sent him a letter about the sale. I didn't feel there was any point in shattering his illusions.
Alma Fenstermacher kissed her on both cheeks.
I hope we run into each other again soon, she said to Nora.
My apartment is right around the corner.
Well, then, Alma said, shrugging into a navy blue jacket. You'll receive an invitation to the Christmas party, as always.
That will be nice, Nora said, and the way she said it and the way Alma smiled told them both that Nora wouldn't go, that she would leave it to her successors, that leaving the block meant leaving the party and the barbecue and all the rest, a tiny dead end leading nowhere. She felt it, felt the weight of all the goodbyes she'd been part of in the last year.
I brought you a farewell gift,
Phil, the spurious homeless man, had said on her last day of work at the museum, and he'd handed her a battered Merriam-Webster's dictionary, the red cloth binding frayed and faded to a pinkish color. On the flyleaf was an inscription in beautiful handwriting, for Arthur Billingham, on the occasion of his graduation from his fond parents, June, 1939.
I like reference books, he said. No surprises in them. Know what I mean?
I won't even ask where you got this, said Nora, letting the tissuey papers riffle through her fingers.
Like I keep telling you, a lot of good stuff gets thrown away in this city.
I'll cherish it, she said.
I know the big boss wanted to get rid of me. I appreciate that you didn't let her. Maybe the new person will try. Maybe I'll move on. There's a side entrance to the Morgan Library I like.
You could try the Met.
Nah, that big showy places are bad, he said. The cops are always moving you along, and there's a lot of competition. Those good humor guys, it's like you want to buy a strawberry shortcake, or you want to give a guy a buck for a sandwich. Most people go with the ice cream, the hot dog. It's hard to blame them. Some of the nice ones buy you food, you know, but I won't eat that stuff. I mean, street dogs? Come on.
I'll stop by sometime and see you, Nora said.
Nah,
Phil said.
That's not how it works. Maybe sometime you'll see a guy on a corner, and you'll think of me. And maybe sometime I'll talk to some lady on the street, and I'll think of you. But we'll never see each other again, probably.
Nora laughed. You're the only one who has been honest about that. The people here, the people on the block where I used to live, everyone says, oh, we'll get together, we'll have dinner, we'll have coffee.
Yeah, that seems like what you ought to say, but it doesn't happen, right?
I guess people say it because it's too sad to say what you said, that's that. Phil shrugged.
New York City is a city of the mind, he said. I'm in yours, you're in mine.
Who are you really? Nora said. A city of the mind? Come on. Are you doing a book on New York street life and this is all research? Am I going to show up in some college course about interactions between the homeless and the people who give them money?
You've never given me money.
Nora reached into her wallet and took out a 20. If I do, will you tell me who you really are? He grinned.
Nah, I wouldn't take your money. And I'm Phil. You know that. I'm Phil. Enjoy the dictionary. You'll remember me when you use it.
Nora kept it on her desk at work, with a plaster vase Rachel had made in second grade, and a paperweight that was Oliver's handprint at age 6. She didn't have anything that Charlie had given her. She'd put her wedding band in the bottom drawer of her jewelry box months ago, when she noticed that Charlie had stopped wearing his. That was the day she and Charlie had met to sign some papers, and had started to talk, and all of it had come pouring out. His feeling that he'd always been her second choice, that he'd taken the wrong turn in his work, that his life somehow felt like a rented house whose rooms were half empty. She thought back to that weekend in Asheville.
New York isn't the real world, he'd said.
Someday soon, he'd decide to move south, work as a financial advisor for some wealthy clients, play a lot of golf. They'd known people who'd done the same, and Nora had always discussed it with contempt, but Charlie had always just kept quiet, and she knew now that he had been thinking her contempt was not only for that life, but for the life he wanted, the life he thought would make him happy. For him. He would marry the nurse and take her away from the daily grind. Nora would have to remind Rachel to be nice. Everyone would move on in ways that would make it seem as though their lives were much the same, perhaps even better. Ricky and Nita had their restaurant in the Dominican Republic, George a new crop of residents to insinuate himself with and then to annoy. Before long, everyone on the block would forget that anyone but Joe had ever snaked out their back drains or washed their windows. Even the story of how Jack Fisk had lit into someone with a golf club, sensational as it was, would begin to dim. Sherry, Linda, Oliver, Rachel, Charlie, Nora. They would all just go on, with resilience or denial or just the right combination of both. People go through life thinking they're making decisions, when they're really just making plans, which is not the same thing at all. And along the way, they get a little damaged, lots of tiny cracks, holding together but damaged still. Ricky would walk with a limp the rest of his life.
Hell, I'd use a damn cane if there was enough money in it,
the man in front of the bodega had said. Nora wondered if that's how Ricky felt. Sometimes she would think of an alternate reality in which Charlie had worked for legal aid, and she had gone to social work school, and their children had gone to public school, and they'd had to turn the dining room into a bedroom because they'd only been able to afford to rent a smallish place. Would that have been so bad? Would that have been so good? The alternate reality she couldn't allow herself was the one in which she never went to the tattooed lady, never met Charlie Nolan and married him, although she knew that there were alternate realities without him that might suit the Nora she was today better. But once there were children, you couldn't zig where you had zagged. It was nothing but a parlor game, once you had children. Sometimes Nora wondered, too, about that alternate universe in which Jack Fisk didn't need to get his car out that particular morning, in which Ricky went about his business as usual. Sherry Fisk didn't move. The Nolans stayed married. No one got a windfall and moved to the Dominican Republic. It was a little like watching a version of It's a Wonderful Life, starring herself. But it also assumed that everything else remained in stasis. Was that what her life had consisted of? A game of statues in the center of a city that changed in ways big and small every single day, even Sundays and holidays, even Shavuot and Ascension Thursday. Landed on her feet, that's what everyone would say of Nora. Still young, her friends whispered, which meant still young enough to marry again. Running the foundation, furnishing her new place, starting fresh, except for Richard. He had followed her from the museum, gone from temporary to permanent. That's more my speed, he'd said, when she described the foundation. And it was. When they received applications for grants, he divided them into two piles, sketchy and not sketchy. Sometimes she took him on visits with her. She had rented office space on 125th Street, a part of the city she never knew before, but which was growing more desirable every day, as every place seemed to have done. The areas of New York that were once shorthand for danger were changing one by one,
until she heard her children's friends talk about renting in places she would never have dared to walk, places in which, if she had gotten off the subway accidentally, she would not have left the station.
"You're saving me a ton of money in rent,"
Bob Harris had said.
"But be careful. Even poor people figure you get what you pay for."
"In 10 years, there won't be any poor people in that neighborhood. Trust me," Nora said. "I don't know if there will be any anywhere in the city."
"The Bible says they're always with us,"
Bob said. "Yeah, pushed into places we don't want to live."
"Now, don't you go getting jaded on me," he said. "You were right for this job because you weren't. Not a bit."
Nora's walk in the morning was different now. North instead of south, east instead of west. When she went downtown to visit another foundation or to look at a charter school, she encountered new pieces of her past, her former self, her ancient history. The tired white brick office building where she had once interviewed with a Princeton alum who had apparently been unimpressed, she had been rejected. The school where she had once been considered for a position as director of development. They had hired instead a very slick young man who later was indicted for writing checks for warm weather vacations and bespoke suits. A restaurant where she and her sister had once had lunch and Christine had spelled out the plans for her new business. A Christmas party at another restaurant when she was pregnant with the twins and had thrown up shrimp puffs in a dark restroom that had an unpleasant smell. The beautiful building on Fifth Avenue, its paneled lobby seen only as a glossy sliver from the street, where she had spent a weekend with a college classmate who had briefly been a friend. Every time she passed it, two thoughts crossed her mind. She wondered how Missy was, and she recalled how entering Missy's parents' duplex from an elevator that opened directly into it, she had seen the living room with its pale yellow sofas and apple green drapes, Central Park, a decorative accent through the enormous windows, and thought, this is what it is like to live in New York. She'd laughed once, recalling it to Christine, as they split a bottle of rosé in the living room, how she had thought life in the city would be so grand, when it ended up quite different from how the Landis family had lived. But Christine had raised one brow and said, if that's an invite to a pity party, I'm not going. Phil was right. New York was a city of the mind. It was a ghost city. And one of the ghosts was Nora Nolan. Young, not so young, single, pregnant, mother, married, not. Somewhere, there was the apartment where she and Charlie began, the hospital room in which the twins were born, the office where she and Charlie had met with the mediator. Somewhere, there was the goose woman, the juggler, the men playing dominoes, the cooler of Dr. Pepper, the aluminum house. George walking his pugs past the place where there had once been a parking lot. New York City was all the strata of the earth. The old was covered over, but it never disappeared. Somewhere in the bake shop, gluten-free, was a flyer for the old pizza parlor, and the shoe repair place that was there before that, and the kosher deli, and so on and so forth, down to the rocky remainders of the creek that once flowed through Midtown before there was a Midtown, before there was an America, that lay now beneath concrete and tar and earth. The price so many of them had paid for prosperity was amnesia. They'd forgotten where they'd come from, how they'd started out. They'd forgotten what the city really was and how small a part of it they truly were. Reinvention, newness was all built on the sturdy back of what was past. Somewhere, a metal shard hammered by a Dutch worker centuries before oxidized in the ground beneath layers of street and road. And above it all, the great city. Now, today, glittery new, just made, a monumental illusion. Nora turned at the corner toward her office, her face raised to a glimmer of light between buildings.
You have a blessed day,
said the man handing out free papers on the corner. You too, she said. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Alternate Side by Anna Quinlan, performed by Ellen Archer. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.